Or Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 222, 100 Years of Mormon Novels, a paper presented by Leo Litke.
Welcome to this session. This is Session 222. Leo Litke, did I say that right?
Yes.
Leo Litke, and the topic is Mormon Novels. Many of you may know more about Leo's work than I do, but I have a book, one of her books here. I don't know how many other people in our culture could say that they've written 35 books, Leo. I certainly couldn't. So she's currently living in Pasadena, California. She grew up in Mink Creek, Idaho, graduated from Utah State, did further studies at City College of New York at Pasadena City and at UCLA, and also taught writing in those last two. So she is the author of over 35 books for teenagers and children. So she's pretty much has a lot of expertise to talk in this topic. And the latest is Lake of Secrets and Searching for Selene. Lake of Secrets is not a Mormon publisher. It's Holt.
New York Public.
Uh-huh. And then Searching for Selene, which is Deseret Book. And she co-authored Stories from the Life of Joseph Smith with Richard Turley. So, Leo, I'll let you go ahead. And she said that it was okay to ask her questions if you want to while she's talking. Is it okay with you if I sit down there so I can
Sure. Watch
up? Okay.
This reminds me once of when a colleague of mine and I were invited to speak at Chapman University down in Southern California. And we prepared this whole big program, the two of us. We were supposed to discuss things back and forth. And we got there, and it was a very rainy day, and we had two people in the audience, so that there were as many in the audience as there were up on the stand. We called that the Leo and Martha Dog and Pony Show for a long time. Okay, I'd like to start with a quote. I meet twice a week with several other writers in Pasadena. We've done this for over 30 years, have met twice a week to read our manuscripts to each other and critique, and we're all successful. We all sell. One of our most famous member is Eve Bunting, with over 250 titles for children and young adults. And she's writing right now. She's in the midst of a book she calls Who Is That Man and What Is He Doing? That's the working title. And it's about a 13-year-old boy who's on a bus tour, and he thinks this man who won't let his tour bag out of his possession thinks he's a terrorist. So it's a very entertaining novel and a lot of fun. But the protagonist is a 13-year-old boy who sees himself as a writer. And in one scene, he goes into a bookstore and he says this: "I'm not sure if reading has a smell, but that's what I always think of when I'm around books. It's the smell of secrets and words and thoughts and adventures." And that's what we find in fiction. And that's what we find in Mormon fiction, too. Now, I think I'm probably the token non-intellectual in this whole group of presenters at the Sunstone, because I'm not a scholar. I'm just a storyteller. However, I did live 37 years with my husband. He was a scholar, and I typed his papers, and I typed his dissertation, so maybe that qualifies me. I don't know. But as a writer of fiction, even young adult, and especially maybe young adult and children's fiction, which is what I do, we all must do scholarly stuff insofar as we have to research any facts that we're using in our books. Which is why I write fiction, because I'm not a researcher, and I'm always afraid I'm going to get things wrong. When I did the book titled Stories from the Life of Joseph Smith, I relied on Richard Turley, who was my co-author. He did all the research, so I figured, you know, nobody was going to question that. Or if they did, they could question him. Now, we who write novels take about the same material as a scholar does, to put together a scholarly paper. But we use the material differently. We incorporate the facts into a story that has a beginning, middle, and end. And real life sometimes makes no sense. But in the novels, we must make some kind of sense. We find or create the sense and build a story around it. So we set up the characters as we need them. to represent different points of view, and we put these people into conflict with obstacles to overcome. We make them suffer. And of course, there's lots of suffering when we get into the stories about Mormon pioneers. So that's fun to write about, because you don't have to search for conflict and suffering. We look for problems to deal with, and we try to reflect real life. When I was doing a series of novels for young girls for Deseret, my editor told me of a note she'd gotten from a woman, or from one of the readers, the first readers, when the manuscript comes in, it's read by first readers. And the woman had read several of the books in the series, and she said about this one, she said, "Why can't Lael just write a happy little book? Her characters always have such problems." Well, problems are the stuff of novels. If you don't have a problem, you don't have a book. Marilyn Arnold, who is an LDS novelist, said this in an article analyzing the relationship between form and content for Mormon writers and readers. She said, "We find some Mormon readers who demand nothing more of writers than inoffensive content, and some literary critics who demand nothing more of writers than technical dexterity. Truly great literature, on the other hand, is produced only in the integration of significant content with significant art. When moralistic but artless writing is accepted as the model for Mormon literature, it perpetuates itself, and the gifted Mormon writer has a difficult time finding an audience. Too many readers would rather have their backs scratched than their minds engaged." That's by Marilyn Arnold. And in an article titled "The Gospel and the Arts," Gerald Lund brings up this problem. What is the balance between artistic freedom and gospel responsibility? He says, let's say an LDS novelist's character is swept up in a mafia society and comes in close contact with a mafia don. This LDS writer firmly and strongly is against profanity. But in this novel, the don has just lost a $3 million drug deal. Now, what does the writer have the mafia don say? "Oh, darn." If you've seen The Sopranos, you know that that's not what he'd say. And there is a dilemma when Mormon writers try to reflect real life. So maybe we stay away from mafia dons. We won't go any further into that, because it could take up several sessions. I'll just say that this is an example of what LDS novelists face in reflecting LDS life. And in this light, I'd like to make one more quote from Lund's article. What is the relationship between form and content in the arts? I remember hearing of a teacher in our seminary system, daunted by the challenge of teaching the Old Testament. She started her class with these words, "Students, your parents probably don't let you go see R-rated movies because they are violent. They depict murder, adultery, immorality, and so forth. Well, you'll be happy to know that this year we're going to study all of these things, murder, adultery, incest, homosexuality, in the Old Testament." Back to the scholarly approach, we novelists must very often arrive at the same conclusions as a scholar, emphasizing the same in a thesis. We call it a theme. But in the meantime, the readers had an adventure, as Eve Bunting said, hopefully becoming emotionally involved in the plight of the characters, hopefully being drawn along by the central drama of the story, hopefully learning something along the way. And I know I'm using hopefully in the wrong way here, but that's all right. I did not do a comprehensive study of Mormon novels. There are just too many. Some of the ones I'm not going to mention too much about are, is it Rachel Nunes, Chris Heimerdinger, Carol Lynch Williams, Susan Evans McLeod, Ann Perry, Richard Paul Evans, Geraldine Edwards. Those are some I didn't get to, but I did want to mention their names because they do write Mormon novels. I might ask here, has the great Mormon novel been written? And I asked this question to one of my retired English teacher friends, Mary Ellen MacArthur, in Southern California. She's also a voracious reader and has read everything, I think. She said, and I quote, "I have yet to read a fully satisfying LDS novel. Most take themselves and life too seriously or too sappily. However, there are a lot around that I haven't read, especially Virginia Sorensen's. What I want to see is a book that captures the texture and feeling of Mormon life, the lives you become intertwined with because of shared faith and ward, lives of people you would never know otherwise, and the many rich interpersonal relationships that result from these unlikely friendships. I think there are powerful novels yet to be written about the tension between the modern, well-educated, liberated young Mormon women who want a support and extended family and values of our church family, but have to struggle mightily to function in a society run by males of a different era. I do think there has to be internal conflict in a successful novel, as well as exterior challenges. That's a quote by Mary Ellen MacArthur. I also asked Mary Bradford the same thing, and she said, if I were to write the great Mormon novel, I would first brainwash myself to erase the whole concept from my mind. Such self-consciousness would kill it. We don't know if anything is great until it's been around for a long time. I would like to read a novel about contemporary Mormons coping with modern life in an authentic way. It would be character-driven, of course, and the characters would have to be people I care about in some way. The sky's the limit. I just want to read a well-written book with human interest. I don't care about angels. I want to read about people coping with grief and loss, about people in love, about people grappling with their faith and their courage. I don't necessarily want to read about disasters. I'm interested in the human heart. I don't want to read a historical novel. Those of the 40s did it best. And she named Virginia Sorensen, Maureen Whipple, and Vardis Fisher, and some of those. She says also, I would like to read works about women coming of age, going through the stages of life, maiden, mother, crone, or wise woman. I'd like to read about a woman breaking out of the mother, grandmother, servant class and setting sail for the wide sea. And she feels that the great Mormon novel has not yet been written, so if you have one in mind, go ahead. As long as I'm into quotes, I'd like to read a couple more. Ernest Hemingway, in true Hemingway fashion, said, "All good books are alike in that they are truer than if they really happened. And after you are finished reading one, you feel that it has all happened to you, and after which it all belongs to you." And another by Arthur Helps. "If you would understand your own age, read the works of fiction produced in it. People in disguise speak freely." Now, Helen Jones used to like this quote, but she said, read not the first-class novels, but the second-class novels, which will not become classics, but she said they reflect a truer picture of an age than the top classic novels. Okay, so this is one reason we read fiction, because people speak freely, because the novelist can put words into the mouths of her characters, which may never have been spoken in real life, and thus making sense of the events. Gerald Lund, who wrote the tomes in the Work and the Glory series, says the three elements for judging the value of a book are edification, entertainment, and excellence. He defines excellence as integration or wholeness. I would also like to add another element, which would be timelessness. The most recent Mormon novel I read is Red Water by Judith Freeman. It was published in 2002. This is a significant novel, especially if you read it in conjunction with John Krakauer's nonfiction book, Under the Banner of Heaven, which is what I did. Both are pretty heavy stuff. Krakauer's premise is that any intense religion or system of thought that promotes absolute obedience and a belief in personal revelation can lead people to fanaticism and violence. He talks about Brian Mitchell, who kidnapped Elizabeth Smart, and the Lafferty brothers, who committed heinous murders. He also cites John D. Lee and the Mountain Meadows Massacre, indicating that religious fanaticism is what drove all of them. And then we come to Freeman's novel and see it all put into based on fact, but fiction. And she can put speeches, she can put things into people's minds and have them make speeches which will make sense of all this. She looks at the story of John D. Lee from three different perspectives. through the eyes of three of his 19 wives. His second wife, Rachel, who married him to stay close to her sister, who was his first wife, his English wife, Emma, and Anne, who married him when she was 13. Freeman says that the novel should be read as a work of fiction, not as a version of history. The reader does well to heed this because it has the feel of history, based as it is on real fact. Freeman did meticulous research and also had ancestors who lived in the desolate part of Utah about which she writes. In a review of the book, Linda Sillitoe says, Freeman's research on the Mountain Meadows Massacre and its aftermath is deep and meticulous, and a rendering so powerful that even a reader experienced in Utah history will understand a place, a time, a horror, and a people in new ways, which is where we benefit from reading fiction. Sillitoe goes on to say, by researching the facts and then moving inside the truth, Freeman illustrates how usually civilized people could commit mass murder, then carry on with their lives. Emma, Rachel, and Anne take us within the guilty silence that erodes a community, as if red water running through a red land soaks the consciousness like spilled blood. Using these three different perspectives is a good thing to do because Rachel's part is told through diaries, which is very subjective. Anne is told from third person, pretty much objective. And Emma tells her part in third person. So we get all these different looks at the story that is unfolding. Well, since that's the most recent one I read, let's go back now 100 years. In an article titled Utah Literature, Lavina Fielding Anderson says, although fiction during the early territorial period was regarded by Mormons with some puritanical misgivings, by the late 19th century they had assigned to their home literature the role of improving the community's morals. One of these, usually defined as the first Mormon novel, was added upon by Nephi Anderson, and it's been in print ever since it was first published in 1898, I think it was. I read that book. Let me get it. I brought it. I saw it in a Deseret bookstore yesterday. It's still available after all these years. I read it when I was very young because my mother had it. My mother was a great reader, farm wife, and a great reader. And so she had this in her collection of books, and I read it when I was about, I don't know, 13 or 14, and I absolutely loved it. I thought it was the best book I ever read because, of course, it was about the people I knew best. I grew up Mormon, in a little Mormon community. Everything I knew was Mormon. And so I read this. I think I was about 15 when my mother bought one called Sweet Love Remembered for me. And I don't remember the author of that for some reason. But it was those two were the first ones that I read. Sweet Love Remembered is about Charles C. Rich and his several wives, which appalled me because it was the first time I really realized what polygamy was. It was a romantic novel, but I kept thinking, romantic? When Marianne is the third wife, and after he romances her, he goes on to romance the others? It turned me off. I didn't like it very much. Except somewhere in the context of the book, it mentioned our little town. The people went from Logan or something through Mink Creek, which was my little town, to Bear Lake. And, of course, that made it very important to me. Now, back to Added Upon. Nephi Anderson attempted to encompass the whole gospel plan in Added Upon. The book starts in the pre-existence, when people meet and a lot of them choose their life's partners there. And he says things like they read life's meaning in each other's eyes. It's pretty much a story of predestination. They meet there, and then when they come to Earth, they are brought together. Alas, one person is not brought together with her lover, Rachel, who remains single throughout her Earth life because she never does find this one that she loved in pre-existence. But all is not lost because they meet each other after death and watch as someone performs the ordinances in the temple. So they do find each other. So it's a happy book. We go with the characters through the spirit world after death and then on into the millennium and end up with exaltation. So you get the whole spectrum in Nephi Anderson's book. He had a message. He saw the gospel as a dynamic force. He wanted to tell how it affected lives throughout eternity. He doesn't hesitate to let his characters suffer, which, as I mentioned, is a requirement of a good novel. Even when they accept Mormonism, they undergo the agonies of doubt and the consequences of their new status. Again, from Levina's article, she cites Susie Young Gates' romance titled John Stevens' Courtship, A Story of the Echo Canyon War, as one of the first Mormon novels. She goes on to say, unlike Arthur Conan Doyle's 1895 thriller, A Study in Scarlet, in which Sherlock Holmes unravels a revenge murder prompted by the death of a woman forced into polygamy, Gates's historical novel does not mention Mormonism's peculiar institution. However, not surprisingly, a great number of Mormon novels do deal with polygamy, as does Redwater. Polygamy offers the opportunity for the novelist to use two of the things that drive drama forward, conflict and sex. The time and place where it was practiced contribute too, because it was frontier with high stakes. Will they survive or will they not? And more opportunity for conflict. The Giant Joshua by Maureen Whipple is undoubtedly the best known of the polygamy novels. Although Virginia Sorensen's Many Heavens is up there too, and her A Little Lower Than the Angels, and The Evening and the Morning, she did a lot. And Helen Hinckley Jones, my longtime teacher and mentor, I studied with her from, I think, 1963 until her death in 1991, the best writing teacher that ever lived, I think. She wrote an excellent polygamy novel titled The Mountains Are Mine in 1946. They're all significant novels, as are Vardis Fisher's Children of God and John Reed Larson's The Everlasting Fire and Paul Bailey's For This My Glory. They all came out in the 50s and 60s. I used to know Paul Bailey. He lived in Eagle Rock, which is just around the mountain from Pasadena, and I don't remember how I met him, but I really enjoyed knowing him. He wrote, besides For This My Glory, he wrote one called The Gay Saint, which we'd have to change the title these days. And he also wrote, he also wrote a little gem called Polygamy Was Better Than Monotony, which I love. And also one called For Time and All Eternity, I think it was called. When I was in Helen's classes in the 1970s, there was a man named George Warren in the class who was very excited when he learned that I was LDS, as was Helen. He had just written a novel titled Destiny's Children with Joseph Smith as a central character, and he had great hopes that it would be a bestseller in Utah. It wasn't. Perhaps because people didn't read novels at that time. Perhaps because he was not LDS. I don't know. I don't know why it didn't sell. It was a pretty good book, proclaiming itself to be the heroic saga of the Mormon's fight for freedom and the courage of the man who won it. Maybe it didn't sell because nobody was interested in Mormons at that time, as evidenced by a letter I received from a magazine. I was writing short stories at that time. And I sent this story about a Mormon family. And I can't even remember which magazine I sent it back. But they sent back a stiff little note saying, I can't think that anybody in our audience of readers would want to read a story about a Mormon family. Times have changed. Now, Mormon books are can be very popular. I had two editors, two of my editors, one at the Harcourt and one at Scholastic, who asked if I could write a young adult Mormon novel. And I said, well, I'd certainly try. So with both of them, I submitted three chapters and an outline, which is what you do when you're making proposals. And I tried to make these Mormon novels. Well, they didn't. I don't know what they had in mind, but it wasn't what I had in mind. And we didn't connect. Then the editor, Ann Wright at Scholastic, said, well, I want you to try once more and really make it a Mormon novel, a young adult Mormon novel. So I started it out with my protagonist sitting in the congregation, and she's watching the young priests as they're blessing the sacrament. And I've got some things, some introspection going on, and as she's watching these young priests and the deacons passing the sacrament. That's how it starts, and then it goes into other things. But I got a letter back from Ann saying, I'm afraid not. This is far too exotic. Did you know we were exotic? Mormons are much better received in the world of publishing these days. And, of course, during the Olympics, we got a lot of coverage in all the national magazines, even in Sports Illustrated. And there was a big article in the New Yorker. And so we are a force to be reckoned with these days, and editors are interested. I'm going to mention some young LDS authors who have succeeded where I failed in a minute. We'll go back to the giant Joshua for a minute. In this book, we encounter 15-year-old Clorinda Agatha, or Clory, who has been talked into marrying her guardian, Abijah, by no less than Brigham Young, who kind of fancies her himself, but asks her to marry Abijah. He tells her that since her father is dead and her mother unable or unwilling to care for her, it would be in her best interest to marry this older man who already has two wives. And since Whipple was writing fiction, she could people her novels with characters who represent what she wants to show and say. One of the other wives is Bathsheba, the capable, powerful Earth Mother type. Earth Mothers are not interested in the fine points of theology. To them, religion is primarily a big lap. And they usually deal with food, which is a symbol of nourishment. Then there's Mousy Willie, the obligatory poor soul who otherwise would not have had a chance to marry and raise up children to God. She's humble and homely, but a dear friend and confidant to Clory. Many of the polygamy novels point up the fact that men often had idealistic as well as perhaps fleshly motives for taking more than one wife. There are many women who might otherwise not have attracted a husband and would not have had children, and so they, in the novels, take these to wife, and probably happened in real life also. In the book, Abijah is called to be among the saints who established the cotton mission down in St. George, which brings in one of the major external conflicts in the book, because the land is harsh, hot, and barren. Can they survive and also live in accordance with the dictates of the church? The stakes are high, with poverty pitted against religiosity. Especially when we add what is the real antagonist in this story, polygamy and its effects on people. Now, in front of this backdrop, the story of Clory takes place, and with her we suffer the agonies of not only physical hardship, but also emotional pain, because, alas, she's married to one man and loves another. She loves the son of Abijah, whose name is, Free. Although this is a first-class novel, a classic in Mormon literature, Whipple uses a modern romance writer's device for increasing tension in the first part of the book. Although Abijah and Clory are duly married, the marriage is not consummated until well into the book, because Abijah doesn't want to force himself on this young wife. Now, this is a ploy that many romance writers use in one way or another, in some of the really trashy romance novels, and then some of the better ones, too. I don't read very many, but I've read quite a bit of that. And he doesn't know that she's secretly in love with his own son. Oh, but this is not a happy novel. Whipple belonged to the realism school of writing, which seems to say that you must never allow the characters to live long and be happy, a basic human need. Rather, they are brought down by rampages of nature or their own weaknesses, as in the old Greek tragedies. where it was the person's own weakness that defeats him. In this novel, we see in stark clarity the harshness of life in a harsh place, but we also see the strength and beauty of the people who try to conquer this land. And what makes them strong in this novel is their faith, their Mormonness, which is demonstrated in many ways. Their total obedience is shown when they want to build a temple, or when they're told to build a temple, and they select a nice dry place where it won't be too hard to do it. Brigham Young comes down and says no. He takes him to a very swampy area and says, no, this is where your temple will be. And they say, you're in the swamp? He says, drain it. And so they do. They are obedient and they build the St. George Temple where it had been a swamp. In a speech he prepared for the 2001 Association for Mormon Literature Conference, Gene England said about this novel, "Let me say straight out that The Giant Joshua is among the finest two or three novels yet produced by or about Mormons." But it was not well received in the LDS community, perhaps because it hit too close to home. Another important early polygamy novel was Virginia Sorensen's A Little Lower Than the Angels. And I'm right now in the process of rereading this. It has a lovely preface by Mary Bradford. And I read it when I was, 14 or 15. Back then, the instructions from Salt Lake seemed to be that you don't read this book because it doesn't reflect what it should. But my mother, being the woman she was, immediately went out and bought it. And after she read it, she says, here, you might want to read this. And so I did. And I missed a lot of things then, being, 14 or whatever I was. But so it's a whole new book reading it now after I've had a little experience in all this long life. The book deals with women associated with the prophet Joseph. And I didn't bring it with me, darn. I was going to quote from Mary's preface, and I forgot to bring the book. It's back on the bedside table. Maybe Mary could tell us what she said. It was a very nice preface, several pages, really good analysis. I once had the then editor of Deseret Book, Eleanor Knowles, tell me that merely having a character go to church and not drink coffee does not make a Mormon novel. She said the characters must act from their Mormonness. It must be their motivating force. Maybe this is why I didn't succeed in putting together a young adult novel. I don't know that I was having them act from their Mormonness, which I'll go back and take a look at now that I know that Mormons writing for young adults can succeed. When I was writing one of my first books with Harcourt, I used LDS settings in three books that I did for them, and especially in one I titled Lloydine in Love. In this book, I had a young LDS couple getting married, and to avoid explaining about temple marriage, I had the ceremony in the ward chapel. I just didn't want to get into it. And my Harcourt editor called me up and asked if this is really how a faithful young LDS couple would get married. And I said, no, they'd probably go to the temple. And she said, well, then take them to the temple. So then I had to figure out how I could explain this whole thing about my main character not being able to go to the wedding and about the reception afterwards and stuff. But it worked. It worked and it was fine. She was happy. I don't know how she learned all this about Mormons, because she was a Jewish lady from New York. But she seemed to know a lot. It was after that then that I got the request to do an overtly Mormon novel and didn't succeed. Dean Hughes, who is I think we're all acquainted with Dean Hughes, who writes, before he wrote the big blockbuster series about the family during World War I, and then another series following that, he was writing young adult books. And he says he also had requests from his publishers to do a Mormon novel, and he says he couldn't do it either. Maybe he and I are just too old, I don't know. But then along came several young adult Mormon authors who succeeded, where we failed. They did sell overtly Mormon novels to major national publishers. And then I think I remember. One of these books is Anne Cannon's Charlotte's Rose, which is about a young girl, a Welsh immigrant, who comes with her family during pioneer times. And she's with this group who are going to cross the plains. One of the young mothers dies giving birth to a baby. And so she promises that she will carry the baby across the plains. It's a the character is not made to be totally good. She has misgivings about this along the way. And it's a good book about this Mormon group and doesn't hesitate to talk about Mormon scriptures. Another one is The Shakeress by Kimberly Houston. And in this book, this girl, I think her name is Naomi, she's left to raise her siblings because their parents die. She encounters the Shakers, who are very good to them. They take them in and they take care of them, and they're so good to them, and she loves the Shakers. But she's kind of interested in a guy, and so she doesn't want to subscribe to their religion of not marrying, not reproducing. She would like to get married and have a family. Well, she encounters Mormon missionaries, and the book quotes extensively from the Book of Mormon, which I didn't even ever think of doing. But Kimberly Houston does it very well, and she tells this story where Naomi then is eventually converted to Mormonism, but then the problems don't stop. And I recommend the book. It's a very interesting book. So it can be done. These two young authors have boldly gone where young Mormons writing for young audiences had never gone before. It's historical. Yeah, it's back at the time, early days of the church. They're both historical novels. Maybe that's what I should try next, a historical novel. But I would like to write a contemporary novel about young Mormons. But I'm still going to try for my national markets. They're still receptive. Now, I want to mention briefly Paul Bailey's novel for Time and Eternity in the line of polygamy novels. In his book, and it's in the early days of the church too, and deals with polygamy, the heroine is Nancy Corey, who is described on the jacket like this: with dark, flashing eyes and an exuberant, almost defiant vitality, young Nancy Corey was extremely attractive and a devout Mormon. Then he sets up his conflict, making his heroine a nice combination of sexuality and religiosity. When a pious apostle proposes that she become his fifth wife, she hits him, calls him a horny old stud, and runs off with a dashing Gentile soldier, loudly proclaiming that she will never be a plural wife. But then Bailey gives the plot a nice little twist, because the soldier, the Gentile soldier she marries, is converted to Mormonism, becomes very involved, and becomes an avid polygamist. I have a collection of polygamy novels that I found over the years in dusty secondhand bookstores. My favorite one is called The Peaceable Kingdom by Ardeth Kennelly. And if you've read that, you know what a delight it is. It was really a bestseller, national bestseller in the 50s, and is perhaps the first humorous Mormon novel. Mary? Oh, how delightful. I'd like to get a copy of that.
The
Salt of the Earth, a play. Yes, this book, I guess I was about, when did it come out? I was around 20 or something, I don't remember, but I was so impressed by the writing and the depiction, the characterizations in here, that it greatly influenced my own writing. The author has a lot of fun with Olaf and his two wives, the frigid, cold Sigrid, and the warm, big-lap Earth Mother, Linnea. And this novel shows us what a friend of mine in New York used to call our quaintness. And it's an endearing quality in the book. I highly recommend it if you can find it. Let's go on to later novels. Deseret Book didn't always publish novels. The Brethren seemed to think novels were a waste of time and did not approve Deseret Book to publish them. Then in the 70s, a woman named Shirley Seeley began writing romance novels with Mormon background. She contacted Deseret Book, but they were not interested. So she self-published them, and they sold like the proverbial hotcakes. Mormon women were hungry for Mormon novels, especially romantic ones. These books were not particularly well written, but they started a rash of self-published Mormon romance novels, which Levina reviewed in an old Sunstone, calling them the Mormon mushies. And I have an article written by Peggy Stack. It was published in the Tribune in 1998, and she says in this article, she says it's called Mormon Novels Entertain While Teaching Lessons. Well, of course we have to do that. LDS women like romance as an escape as much as others, says Joanne Jolly, managing editor at Covenant Communications, who oversees the company's romance writers. If they can get it and feel good and clean about it, all the better, Jolly says. These novels have some suggestive scenes, but also show how the gospel can bring light and life into a person's life, she says. Two, such books are people with recognizable LDS characters, Brigham Young University students, missionaries, converts, bishops, Relief Society presidents, religion professors, homeschoolers, and they are laced with theological certainty. Lots of Mormons feel they can't go to the movies or watch TV. They are starved for a kind of entertainment that carries with it a little didactic pressure, says Neil Kramer, president of the Association of Mormon Letters. Much of it is fairly superficial moralizing, he says, but it is consistent and rings true to the first level of defense most Mormons feel. Oh, then he says, the storybook romance ends with a wedding, but always in the temple, says BYU professor Richard Craycroft. And I always think when I read them, I think, well, here's where the real story starts, because they've had all this conflict and finally everything clears up and they have the wedding. But then what happens afterward? The conflict doesn't go away, so I'm always a little nervous with these books. At this time, Deseret Books started publishing a few novels, I spoke with Eleanor Knowles, who was the editor then, and asked if I could submit a novel, a young adult novel for girls, and she said no. She said in the first place, Deseret wasn't really into fiction, and in the second place, she didn't think they'd ever publish books for young people. In the mid-80s, after I've had a couple of novels published nationally, she called me saying she'd seen my books reviewed in Publishers Weekly, and would I like to submit a book to her? And I said, sold a short story titled Charlie to the New Era, and Eleanor liked it so much she encouraged him to make it into a novel, and she helped him. Deseret Book published it. It sold exceedingly well, which made it easier for me and other novelists to sell to Deseret Book. Jack went on to sell dozens of books to Deseret and is still doing it, all about conversions. He and I were both speaking at a writer's conference once, and I said, well, Jack, why don't you ever try national markets? And he says, no, I write only conversion stories. My first book for Deseret was, I think, in 1986. It was titled Where the Creeks Meet, and I admit that it wasn't really what Eleanor defines as a Mormon novel. Although the kids in it went to church and family home evening, they weren't motivated because of their Mormonness. How she could commit such a sin in the first place. For instance, her husband conducted weekly interviews with the rest of the family, and he would sit at a high desk and they would be down below sitting on chairs. So he would have this superior position to begin with, and then he would dictate what they were going to be doing. And his motto for everything was, if our pioneer forefathers could do it, so can we, whether it was a worthwhile project or not. This led into Carol doing a subsequent book titled If the Gospel is True, Why Am I So Miserable?, which was also published by Deseret Book. Eleanor liked Carol's manuscript when it came in, but figured that since it started out with adultery, it wouldn't pass the committees and the Brethren. But everyone who read it said, we must publish this. And so they did, and it was an LDS bestseller in the 80s. This is definitely a Mormon novel. The characters react to the various situations out of their Mormonness, and in the novel we see the chinks in our own armor. She went on to do several other books for Deseret. And about this time, Blaine Jorgensen wrote Charlie's Monument, which was also a very popular novel. One type of book that's become popular in the past decade or two is the humorous Mormon novel. And I think a writer named Catherine Kidd was the one who probably began this trend with a book titled You're a Rock, Sister Lewis, and another titled Paradise View, both published by Orson Scott Card's company called, I think it was Hatrack River Press. Paradise View is the name of a ward in the book, and it's spelled V-U-E. The meeting house has a huge stained glass window that faces west, looks out over the lake. And Paradise View Ward meets in the afternoon when the sun streams through the window, so all the congregation wear dark glasses to church. This is something that just is part of the ward. And the book deals with the Relief Society president and her counselor who go to visit every sister in the ward. And as you read, you recognize every one of them because you've got them in your own ward. Another Mormon writer who handles humor well is Linda Hoffman Kimball, who is here at the conference. Her latest book is The Marketing of Sister B, which is a story of an LDS woman who creates a perfume for an enrichment night for little handouts. And she creates this perfume out of homey smells like cinnamon. That's the predominant smell in it. It reminds people of wonderful things baking in the oven. So they all love it. In fact, it becomes so popular it begins spreading. And it becomes a national perfume. A national company picks it up. They sell it. She becomes a national celebrity. But when a large perfume company buys the rights to the perfume, they rename it Cinnamon, S-I-N-A-M-O-N. What is this good LDS sister to do when her innocent perfume becomes a sex symbol? Although the book is humorous, it asks some really serious questions, such as, who defines us? What is authentic and what is just marketing? And of course, we're all acquainted with Orson Scott Card's books. He does a lot of Mormon novels also. And a lot of non-Mormon novels. My favorite, I think, is Past Watch, which is not a Mormon novel, but really very good. And he wrote a decidedly Mormon novel called A Woman of Destiny for the national publisher, and I think Deseret Book published it under the title of Saints or something. And you think you're reading about Eliza R. Snow in this book, but you're not. Dinah Kirkham is a fictional character, but she kind of stands in for Eliza in that she's married to both Joseph and Brigham. There's one rather steamy scene between Brigham and Dinah that brings to mind something Eliza was supposed to have said about Joseph, I think it was. In her later years, someone commented that there was a rumor that she was a virgin. She was supposed to have smiled and said, "You know Joseph better than that." Back to humorous LDS novels. Joni Hilton wrote several. As the Ward Turns is one of them, where, as I recall, a Relief Society president uses a dead cat as a visual aid. And the jacket blurb says, "You'll meet Bishop Carlson, who impersonates the deceased at a funeral, and Edith Horvitz, a homemaking director who built her entire house using particle board and a glue gun." Shades of the old Relief Society. Now, I haven't read any of Gerald Lund's Work in the Glory series because I figure if I got into them, I'd spend the next 6 years reading them, wouldn't get anything else done. But I have read Dean Hughes' books about the family during World War I, and then the present series is about the same family, the children and their children in the 60s. Dean does his women characters very well, I think. The only trouble I find with his books is that the characters are all too good. Oh, they're unbelievable good. That's not a criticism, but it's... because I really like both him and I like his books. I find a recent book by John Bunyan deals more realistically with how people are. It's called Falling Toward Heaven, and he presents Elder Howard Rockwood, who is just completing an honorable mission to Texas, although he has had major doubts about a lot of things along the way. When his mission ends, he doesn't go home. He goes off instead to Alaska to shack up with a girl that he met in Texas where he was on his mission. They set up housekeeping together. He has twinges about abandoning his faith, but he finds his new life exciting. He takes his girlfriend, Allison, back to his little desert hometown in Utah. And of course, there are a lot of raised eyebrows. And he's surprised at how affected he is at being back in his childhood environment. And as things go along, his girlfriend encourages him to go back into the religion because she thinks that he'll be happier that way. Yes?
Oh, I wanted to
raise my hand. Oh, okay. We're coming to an end here. I did want to mention some of the books about Mormons written by non-Mormons. There's one called Tabernacle by Thomas Cook. It has the angel Moroni on the jacket. In this book, there's a killer loose on the clean and straight streets of Salt Lake City. The jacket blurb says, "Against this killer stands Detective Tom Jackson of the Salt Lake Police. Jackson must cut through official ineptitude, blindness, and cover-up to get to the shattering truth at the center of the Tabernacle, at the dark heart of the Mormon faith." And in, I think it's, what's the name of the one I'm thinking of? I think it's in Kingdom Come by Peter Bart. He has the General Relief Society president having an affair with the president of the church, which is very highly unlikely. And so people see us in many different ways. One of my writing teachers said once that if you have a journey in a book, you can hold your reader's interest. We have a journey. We have persecution. We had polygamy. We had secrets. There are all kinds of things that make for good novels, Mormon novels. In my own latest Deseret book, and I didn't bring that either, Searching for Selene, Dennis Lithgow gave me a really nice review in the Deseret News on this book. And I think I came closer in this one to having people act out of their Mormonness than anything else. To conclude, in novels we see ourselves, our attitudes, our culture reflected back to us from the novelist's mind. As Stendhal, a major writer, said, "A novel is a mirror carried along a main road, and we might do well to look into that mirror." Thank you. There's time for one question if anybody has one. Yes?
I'm curious to know, the fact that national presses are interested in Mormon and Gentile novels suggests that they are hoping to market these things nationally.
Oh, yes.
Mormon market.
No, they want to do...
My question is, why do you think they think that non-Mormon young adults would be interested in
I think because they like to novels about all kinds of things. I read a wonderful novel not too long ago by a woman in my area, named, I can't remember what it was named, but it was about the Oneida community. And this, the Shakeress, gives a great deal of information about the Shakers. Since Mormons are widely accepted now and honored and looked up to and people are curious about it. I think it's just another thing that they think that young people who are questing to learn about various things would like to read about, because there hasn't been a whole lot about it.
So it's interesting that the ones that have succeeded so far have been historical.
Yes.
You suggest that that's both you and Dean are having a much harder time figuring out how to tell the contemporaries.
Yes, but we'll succeed. Thank you.